I want you to picture a hallway. It's late April 1972. The air probably smells like floor wax and, I don't know, cheap cologne. You're standing in a dormitory. It's called Helaman Halls. And there's this wall of brass mailboxes. And standing right there, just staring at one of them, is a 19-year-old kid named Darwin Rasmussen. He's holding a thick white envelope.
The envelope,
The
the
envelope.
one every young man in that dorm is waiting for and terrified of, all at the same time.
Exactly. He knows that whatever is printed on the paper inside that envelope, well, it defines the next 2 years of his life. It's where he lives, what he eats, who he even talks to. But here's the thing that makes this seem, a little different. Darwin wasn't like the other guys. Most of them were probably hoping for something scenic, maybe the Swiss Alps.
Or Japan. Somewhere with a bit of adventure, maybe a little romance, or let's be honest, somewhere warm.
Right. But Darwin, he had been privately praying for something very specific. He
Yeah.
didn't ask for the postcard experience. He didn't ask for easy. He told God, send me to the hardest place.
Which is such a bold, almost reckless prayer for a teenager to make. You're basically asking for trouble. You're inviting the refiner's fire before you even know what heat feels like.
You really are. So with that prayer kind of hanging over him, he rips it open. He's standing there all alone. He unfolds the letter. He scans past the formalities, the Dear Elder Rasmussen, and his eyes just land on one word. Finland.
And that one word, Finland, that's the anchor for this whole deep dive. Today, we're unpacking a fascinating, really unique collection of memoirs. It's titled Six, Our Calls to Finland. And these are the personal histories of young men and women in that specific window, 1972 to 74, who were all funneled toward a country that, honestly, most of them couldn't point to on a map if you paid them $100.
It's such a cool slice of history. We're gonna look at how this group, who seemed totally unconnected, all ended up in this one cold corner of the world. It's a story about the Vietnam War era, the draft lottery, all that stuff, but it's also about what Darwin Rasmussen calls a divine algorithm.
I love that phrase, divine algorithm. It really captures the tension you see in these documents. Because on one hand, you have the chaotic reality of the 1970s total upheaval wars ending. And then on the other, you have these deeply personal, almost impossible coincidences that suggest something much more orchestrated was happening behind the scenes.
So let's ground this for a second. Before we get to the snow and the saunas, we have to understand the room these kids were standing in. It's the early 70s. What's the actual vibe?
Oh, stressful. It was stressful. You have to remember, this isn't like today where a mission is just a rite of passage for many or a choice you make without a lot of external pressure. This is the Vietnam era. The war is technically winding down, but it's still very much in the headlines. Watergate is brewing. And the draft. The draft is the monster in the closet.
And it wasn't just some vague threat, right? It was a numbers game.
It was pure math. In the documents, one of the writers, Bruce Kelgi, he brings up the 1972 draft lottery specifically. If you were a young man turning 19, your whole future depended on your birthday. They pulled dates out of a drum. If your birthday got a low number,
You're going to boot camp.
you're going to war. High number, you might be safe to go to college or a mission.
That adds a layer of desperation to these calls that I think we forget about. It wasn't just, where will I serve? It was, am I going to be carrying a scripture case or an M16?
Precisely. And the church itself was different too, much, much smaller. We're talking maybe 15,000 missionaries worldwide back then.
Wow.
Today, it's tens of thousands. Back then, there was a strict quota. Only two missionaries could be sent from any single ward, any congregation at a time.
So just getting permission to go was a bottleneck. You had to wait your turn.
It was a scarcity economy. So receiving a call was a huge deal. And because information was so scarce, I mean, no internet, no Wikipedia, no Google Earth, where you went felt like a total roll of the dice. You open that envelope and the world map just spun.
And when that dice rolled Finland, the reaction wasn't exactly excitement. It sounds like it was mostly just confusion.
Confusion is putting it lightly. Gary Carter, one of the memoirists, he captures it perfectly. He opens his letter, sees Finland, and his immediate internal thought is, where the heck is that? He's genuinely baffled.
I think Darwin Rasmussen's story is my favorite on the ignorance factor. He calls his mom, right?
He does. He runs to the phone, and
Yeah.
his mom doesn't know either. She literally has to go pull out the Family Encyclopedia, Volume F. She's reading stats to him over the phone while he's standing in the hallway, probably sweating. She's like, 150,000 lakes,
Right.
land of the midnight sun.
Which sounds poetic, but it doesn't tell you what your life is going to be like. It's a tourism brochure, not a survival guide.
And the grapevine information they did get was often just comically wrong. Gary Carter mentions a friend's mother who tried to be helpful. She told him Finns looked Asiatic, like they came from the Russian steppes.
Which is not right.
Yeah.
Not even close. But then she dropped the real bomb. She told him, oh, and by the way, Finnish is the most difficult language in the world to learn.
Great. Thanks for the pep talk.
Exactly. It just ramps up the anxiety.
Yeah.
And then you have Margaret Bridges. Her story is the ultimate example of a mismatch, at least on paper. She's a convert from upstate New York. Really smart, educated. She'd taken 5 years of French.
So natural, I mean, logically, you send her to Paris or Geneva.
You would think.
Or maybe Montreal.
She goes to the mission home, and there's this huge group of missionaries heading to France. She's all ready to go, and then she finds out she's the only one in her whole group sent to Finland.
That has to be jarring. 5 years conjugating French verbs, thinking you've got a leg up, and suddenly you're sent to a language family that has absolutely nothing to do with Romance languages.
It really highlights that feeling of being a stranger in a strange land. Mark Meadows mentions he literally had to find a world map just to figure out how far north he was actually going. He's tracing his finger up past Germany, past Denmark, past Sweden.
And realizing he's basically going to the Arctic Circle.
Right. But here is where the deep dive gets really interesting. Because if you just look at the surface, it looks random. Guy takes French, goes to Finland. Guy wants Italy, goes to Finland. It looks like a bureaucratic mix-up. But when you dig into the memoirs, you start finding these weird, highly specific threads connecting them to this place.
This is that divine algorithm coming into play.
That's it. And my favorite example of this, because it involves a bit of boldness, is Greg Colton.
I love this story. So he's in his interview with his stake president, the regional leader who has to sign off on his papers. And usually when they ask, where do you want to serve?
Mm-hmm.
There's a script. You give the standard Sunday school answer.
I'll go where the Lord wants me. It's the polite, humble, expected answer.
Right. And Greg tries to play that card. But the stake president isn't having it. He pushes him. He's like, no, Greg, stop the fluff. Tell me where you actually want to go.
And Greg finally breaks. He says, as far away from Utah as possible.
Which, fair enough. Sometimes you just need a little distance.
But the president pushes him again. What country? Finally, Greg admits the truth. He says he really admired his former bishop, a man named Robert Wade. And Bishop Wade had just been called as the mission president, the leader in Finland. Greg says, I want to serve under him.
That is a massive long shot. You can't usually request a specific boss in the mission field. It's not like asking for a transfer in the corporate world.
No, but the stake president actually wrote it down in the notes. He respected the honesty. And lo and behold, Greg got the call. It wasn't random. It was a specific desire to follow a mentor.
Yeah.
But then you have David Roberry. His story is the one that gave me actual goosebumps.
This is the one that just defies the odds, right?
Statistically, it feels impossible.
Mm-hmm.
So David's father had served in Finland way back in 1949, right after the war. So David has this legacy connection. He wants to go where his dad went.
Okay.
But then disaster strikes. His next door neighbor gets his mission call first.
And let me guess.
It's Finland.
Oh, no. So David is crushed.
He is devastated. He's doing the math in his head. He's thinking there is zero chance, zero, that the church sends two guys from the same ward, let alone next-door neighbors, to the same tiny mission in Finland months apart. He figures the quota is filled. His chance is gone.
But then his envelope comes.
And he's going to Finland.
It's amazing.
But it gets better. Later on, he's in Helsinki, at the mission office specifically. He's up in the attic at a place called Neitsyt Polku. He's digging through old records, maybe just curious. And he finds documents from 1949. He finds papers with his father's actual signature on them.
Wow.
He is literally walking in his father's footsteps, handling the paper his father handled.
Yeah.
Stops looking like a lottery and starts looking like a legacy. Like history was waiting for him to arrive.
That's incredible. But speaking of history in these loops, we have to talk about Bruce Galgiou. This one's a bit complicated, so walk us through it. This involves a famous signature, doesn't it?
It is a beautiful historical loop. So Bruce gets his call. And at the bottom of the letter, the signature is President Joseph Fielding Smith. Now, for those who don't know the lineage, Joseph Fielding Smith is the grandson of Hiram Smith. Hiram was the brother of the prophet Joseph Smith.
Okay, so we've got a signature from Hiram Smith's grandson on the call letter. That's cool, but what's the connection to Bruce?
Well, rewind 140 years. Hiram Smith was a missionary himself in the early days of the church. And one of the people Hiram converted was a man named Isaac Allred.
And let me guess, Isaac Allred is related to Bruce.
Isaac Allred is Bruce Galgiou's direct ancestor. So Hiram Smith brings the gospel to Bruce's family in the 1830s, And now, 140 years later, Hiram's grandson signs the paper, sending Bruce to take that same gospel to Finland. Bruce calls it closing the circle.
That is mind-blowing. It really makes you wonder about the timing of things. Like, if Bruce had been born a year later or sent his papers in a month later, that signature would have been different. Joseph Fielding Smith was very old at this point.
Exactly. It felt personal. It felt targeted. But before we get too focused on the American side of things, we can't ignore the local perspective. This wasn't just a one-way street of Americans being shipped over. We have the story of Ann Torpo Jotunis. She is a Finnish convert living in Tampere.
And her road was a lot harder than just waiting for an envelope.
Oh, much harder. The Americans dealt with the draft, but Anne dealt with active opposition. Her parents opposed her going on a mission. She had no money. In Finland at that time, for a young woman to just leave everything to preach religion, it was unheard of. It was culturally strange.
It seemed impossible.
It did. But she prays, and she hears a voice say, "It is now your time." And suddenly, things just unlock. A friend offers her a job so she can save up. She gets the independence she needs, and she goes to the mission president, Robert Wade, remember, the same guy Greg Colton wanted to serve with.
And what was Wade's reaction? Because usually mission presidents are trying to manage, you know, too many missionaries.
Not in this case. He told her, "You are the answer to my prayers." They were desperate for a Finnish sister missionary who actually knew the culture and the language. So while the Americans are freaking out about where Finland is on the map, Anne is in Finland praying for a way to serve, and the timelines just, they converge perfectly.
It creates this picture of a web, doesn't it? Like, everyone is moving into position. But even with all these spiritual connections, getting there wasn't just a matter of opening an envelope and hopping on a plane. The documents mention a real struggle to serve.
Absolutely. It wasn't a given. Just because you got the call didn't mean you made it to the tarmac. Take Scott Perkins. He admits he was on what he calls the road to rationalization.
I think a lot of people can relate to that, the I'll do it later mindset.
Or the I'm doing enough already mindset.
Yeah.
Scott joined the Army National Guard. He told himself, "Look, I'm serving my country. I'm avoiding the draft legally. Maybe that's enough." He started losing his resolve to go on a religious mission. It just felt like too much of a sacrifice. He was comfortable.
But then life has a way of intervening.
It does. He gets hit with severe pneumonia while he's training at Fort Lewis.
And we're not talking a bad cough.
No, we're talking a 105-degree fever. He's delirious. That is dangerous brain damage territory. He really thought he was going to die. And in that hospital bed, in the middle of the night, he makes a bargain with God.
The classic foxhole prayer.
Exactly. He says, "Make me well, and I will serve."
And did he get better?
He did. Local missionaries came and gave him a blessing, and he recovered. Now, he admits he still waffled a bit after that. Yeah. Human nature, right? Once the fever breaks, you start rationalizing again. But he knew he had made a promise.
Mm.
That illness was the pivot point that pushed him to Finland.
It is intense. And then on the flip side, you have Mike Bosley.
Yeah.
No health crisis, but just a brutal grind. He was a convert from Texas. He didn't have family money supporting this. He had to work for 2 full years just to save the cash to go.
Which shows a whole different kind of commitment. For Mike, it wasn't just about being called. It was about earning the right to go. He had to resolve a medical issue, save every penny. By the time he got on that plane, he was invested in a way some of the 19-year-olds might not have been.
So they overcome the draft, the rationalization, the finances, the pneumonia. They get on the plane, they land in Helsinki, and now reality hits. And the first wall they hit is that language.
The most difficult language in the world, as the rumor went. And honestly, the rumor wasn't that far off. Finnish isn't like Spanish or German, it's Finno-Ugric. It has 15 noun cases. It's a fortress of a language.
Darwin Rasmussen talks about the ache of homesickness at 3 a.m, but he phrases it so beautifully. He says it's the ache that hits in a language you are still learning to dream in.
That is profound. It's that feeling of your brain not quite being your own yet. You're a toddler again. You can't express yourself. You're just isolated inside your own head. It's so lonely.
And beyond the language, the country itself had this very specific reputation. Gary Carter talks about honest little Finland. I found this fascinating. This is about the war debt, right?
Correct. This is a huge point of pride for Finns. After World War I, Finland had borrowed about $9 million from the U.S. for food supplies. By the 1970s, Finland was the only European debtor that had paid back its loan in full to the United States.
Wow. Everyone else just defaulted.
Defaulted, renegotiated, or just stopped paying. Finland paid every single cent, and that earned them a lot of respect in America. It spoke to their national character, what they call sisu.
Sisu, define that for us.
It's a Finnish word that doesn't really translate perfectly, but it means guts, resilience, determination in the face of just impossible adversity. The idea that it must be done, so I will do it. It's a hardness, but a good hardness.
But that Sisu was born out of necessity, right? I mean, life there wasn't soft.
No. Bruce Kalyana shares a story from his branch president that is vivid. The president showed him slides from the 1950s in Finland. One picture was him lying on a table in a public sauna getting scrubbed with a rough brush.
Like a spa day.
Not exactly. This was hygiene survival. Yeah. Most people didn't have showers in their apartments in the 50s and 60s, so you went to the public sauna once a week, you got scrubbed down, you sweated it out, and that was your bath.
That's a massive culture shock for an American kid from the suburbs who's used to a hot shower every morning.
Huge.
Yeah.
And then there's the weather. Darwin describes winters that swallow the sun. You have to imagine these guys riding bicycles, because that's how they got around. Through blizzards, in the dark, at 2 in the afternoon. It takes a physical toll that's hard to describe if you haven't lived it.
And yet, despite the cold, despite the dark, the memoirs describe this intense pride in the people. Gary Carter mentions his uncle singing Finlandia at his farewell.
Which is Sibelius's hymn. It's incredibly powerful. It was born from Finland's struggle for independence from Russia. So these missionaries weren't just walking into a cold place. They were walking into a place with a fierce, hard-won identity. The Finns knew who they were, and they were proud of it.
So let's zoom out a bit. We've covered a lot of ground. We've got Darwin with his boomerang.
Yeah, wait, we have to explain the boomerang. We can't just drop that.
Oh, right. Darwin Rasmussen carried a boomerang with him. Why?
He just loved that song, My Boomerang Won't Come Back. It was this quirky, personal totem he brought to the mission field. It's absurd, right? Standing in the Finnish snow with a boomerang, but it makes him so human.
I love that detail. It reminds you they were just kids. So you've got Darwin with his boomerang and praying in Tampere, Scott making deals with God in a hospital bed. They're all so different. But they all end up in this one specific mission.
It really brings us back to Darwin's conclusion. After looking back at all these stories 50 years later, he realized it couldn't have been just about fitting a quota. He wrote something that stuck with me. He said, Sister Piesse needed to sit in her bedroom at precisely the right moment.
Meaning she, a woman in Finland investigating the church, needed a specific missionary to knock on her door right then.
Exactly. He believed that their personalities were matched to the families that needed them. If you had sent the guy who wanted to go to Italy to that house, maybe the door wouldn't have opened. Maybe the connection wouldn't have been made. It's the idea that the call isn't just a location assignment. It's a matching of souls.
And there's one final detail that I think symbolizes this transition of eras perfectly. We talked about Bruce's call being signed by Joseph Fielding Smith,
who was 95 years old.
Yeah.
Linked to the very founding of the faith.
But then you have Mike Bosley, who came just a little later. His call was signed by Spencer W. Kimball.
It was a changing of the guard. Joseph Fielding Smith passed away just weeks after signing those letters for Darwin and Bruce. So you have this group of missionaries straddling two eras of church history. They are the bridge generation. But the destination Finland remained the anchor for all of them.
It's a powerful reminder that while the names at the bottom of the letter change, and the geopolitical situation shifts from Vietnam to whatever comes next, the experience of the individual remains pretty constant.
It does. And that brings us to the big question for you, for the listener.
Yeah. What should we take away from this? Why does a story about 1972 matter today?
I want you to think about the major assignments in your own life. Maybe it was a job transfer you didn't want. Maybe it was a college acceptance letter, or even just the random way you met your partner. At the time, did it feel like random chance, like you just pulled a card out of a deck? Or, if you look back now with the benefit of hindsight like Darwin, looking back 5 decades later, can you see a signature on it? Can you see the hidden connections, the ancestral loops, or the specific timing that suggests maybe, just maybe, you were exactly where you needed to be?
That is something to chew on. From boomerangs to snowstorms, thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Finland.
It was a pleasure.
We'll see you in the next one.